This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's the holiday season, a time when many kids hope to find the latest toy under the tree. But in our age of technology, Barbies and Legos find themselves competing for space with smartphones, tablets, and gaming consoles. However, for some parents, these gifts are a source of anxiety as they weigh the pros and cons of exposing their children to what might be too much media and tech amid an ongoing debate over how unlimited access to the digital world can affect a child's social and intellectual well-being. But technology is not going away, and many experts also agree kids must learn how to use these new tools safely and productively. So, how should parents manage their kids' use of all this? And by the way, what about adults themselves, who our guest today says often model the exact kind of screen-obsessed behavior they bemoan in the younger generation? Today in The Exchange, we're talking with author Yelda Uhls about her new book, Media Moms and Digital Dads. It offers what she calls a fact-not-fear approach toward parenting tech-savvy kids. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments and concerns are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Yelda Uhls joins us from Utah. And Yelda, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I very much appreciate being on the show.
Well, there's some really funny quotes that you sprinkle throughout the book, Yelda, from earlier eras, much, much earlier eras, where adults express their angst about, you know, these newfangled technologies and developments and how it's going to poison young brains and young souls. Give us a couple examples, Yelda, and what's this all about?
Well, one of them I just loved, and actually it opens most of my talks when I give them. There was this one new media that came out around the turn of the 19th century, late 1800s, and parents were terrified it was going to ruin young teenagers' brains because they were like adopting it at a rapid pace and, you know, devouring these things. And it turns out that this media was the romantic novel.
Right. And today, parents would love to see their kids curled up on a couch reading a novel, right?
Exactly. And in fact, one of the authors of the romantic novels that parents were terrified was Jane Austen. So today, as I like to say, if my teenager wanted to read Jane Austen, I'd be thrilled. So the point is, we adapt. We adapt to every new media. We did the same thing with radio. We did the same thing, you know, when the computer was introduced. There are books called Disconnected from 20 or 30 years ago. There are books just from a few years ago called the same thing. We keep doing this. We keep saying it over and over and over again. Every new media comes along. Parents freak out. Adults freak out. We're not used to it. Young people adopt, you know, love it. And then slowly but surely, we adapt.
Well, the same thing happened when Gutenberg invented the printing press, right? People said this
Absolutely.
Is going to be terrible. You even have a quote in here about, I think it's like 4th century B.C. People are concerned that the development of the written word would wipe out our memories. Give us a little more there, Yelda.
Exactly. So Plato, he wrote a play called Phaedrus. And in that play, he talked about the fear that with the written word, memory would decline. And because once you start writing words, you don't have to memorize. Back then, it was the oral tradition. That's how we communicated and passed on knowledge. And his fear was that the written word would ruin everything, the downfall of civilization, which I think many people would argue that is not true.
Well, and here's a little bit on the novel from your introduction. It's funny. I'm going to share it with people, Yelda. You say, near the end of the 19th century, a new medium was unleashed upon the world. Children took to it like ducks to water, and this terrified adults. Young people everywhere spent hours on end immersed while simultaneously ignoring the grown-ups in their lives. Understandably, parents were alarmed and worried that this new medium and its racy content were ruining young minds. And then again, as you say, it's the novel. But then you go on to say, okay, so yeah, it's kind of funny to look back at that now. Are you saying then, Yelda, that we shouldn't worry at all?
No. And I mean, I think every generation has to adapt. You know, kids probably, if we let them leash, you know, even a child who reads too many books is probably avoiding something. You know, I have a friend, her daughter would read so much that she would get upset because she felt she was avoiding social contact. So every single media, we have to adapt. We have to look at it. We have to do research on it. We have to figure out what are the pros, what are the cons, what are the norms of behavior. And indeed, one of the questions I explore too is it really different this time? Because with mobile technology, which has taken off so quickly, and young children, little babies can use it. I mean, they couldn't read. They don't even sit and watch TV, but yet they can use an iPad and iPhone. Is it different this time?
So is it? What do you think?
Well, I looked at the research, and yes, so, I mean, that is indeed different. And you know, there is indeed some issues, some ways that our brain is changing. And in the past, you know, maybe our memory has changed indeed because of the written word, because our brain is adaptive. We adapt to new environments, and we you know, that's partially how we evolve. So, yes, it could be different, but that doesn't mean that it's better or worse. It just means that we're changing and we're adapting and becoming, you know, the next generation.
What are the biggest fears, Yelda, around this? You know, the top two or three or four that you hear from people all the time.
A lot of people are worried that their kids are addicted. They actually use that word. And I understand that. I have a son that loves computer games. And when he's playing those computer games, that word resonates in my own head. And I have a daughter who loves taking selfies. She's on Instagram. So I get that. But addiction is a very serious disease. So it's not necessarily that kids are addicted. It's that they're obsessed. So that's one thing. Distraction. People feel like the brain is changing. People really worry about cyberbullying. They worry about privacy. I worry a lot about privacy. And I also worry about, you know, people not learning to look each other in the face. I mean, that's why it's really incumbent upon the adult to give your child time off the devices, time in conversation, and also to role model that.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guest today is Yelda Uhls. She's the author of Media Moms and Digital Dads. She works with Common Sense Media, a nonprofit advocacy group for families. And she's a research scientist at UCLA. You can join us with your questions and comments. What are your biggest concerns about the rise of digital media, the availability of it in our pockets at all times? What are some of the benefits of this? What do you think the research says? 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Yelda, before we get into kids, there's some big sort of societal issues. I mean, it isn't just young people who are using their phones to look something up or, you know, check Facebook or whatever. And a huge theme in your book is mutual responsibility. A lot of what you say, Yelda, in this book is aimed at parents, actually, not just the kids.
Yeah, it's totally true. And you know, by the way, I have to look myself in the mirror all the time. You know, I mean, I reveal a lot about myself in this book. It's a very laid back style. And my husband is a screenwriter. I used to be in the film business. So we both love media. I love watching television. I love, I'm binge watching right now. We have movie screeners, you know. So my own media, I also read a lot, is very prevalent in our house. So I have to watch my own media. And role modeling is one of the ways that kids learn, especially when they're very young. They're watching and learning from us all the time. One of the things that I say in the book, and I'm giving away a lot, but children learn to drive at the age of 5. I was shocked when I found that out, because they're watching you at the age of 5 and actually starting to pick up on what you're doing driving. So I make a point in my talks, if you don't want your child to text and drive, you have to really be careful, even when they're very, very young, and watch your behavior in the car. So every single thing that you do, they're watching and learning from you, and that includes your media habits.
Or, you know, staring at your phone while you're pushing the swing at the playground. You know, 20 years ago, a parent pushing the swing might have talked to their kid or sung to their kid while they're pushing the swing. Today, they're just looking at the phone while they sort of absentmindedly push the child. What impact does that have on the little kid?
Well, and you know, I like to always consider both sides. So, yes, they might have sung to their kid. They might have done something else. But I have a friend who 15 years ago wrote a great poem about being very bored while their child was at the playground. And I remember that too. Your child's off playing. You can't spend every single second staring at them.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, sometimes we are staring at our phones when we should be looking at our kids, and we have to be very conscious of that behavior. Other times you might have to stare at your phone. And the other thing I like to point out too is, I mean, having a phone and having a mobile device might allow you today to go to the park with your child when before you would have had to be in an office. So we need to sort of look at both sides. But
sure, I have to stay home. I'm waiting for this call. Yeah, go ahead.
There is a very, very funny website called Parents on Phones. It's a Tumblr website, and they post photos all the time of parents pushing their kid. And sometimes it's actually very poignant, because you can tell the kid wants the parent's attention, yet they're staring at their phone.
You know, you mentioned your own story, Yelda, and said you love to watch movies and TV. And prior to your academic career, you did spend over 15 years in the entertainment industry. Give us a little more on that, Yelda, because that's kind of interesting. How does that inform or shape the work that you do now? You're not sort of an anti-screen person by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I'm not a hater. I went into the film business because I'm fascinated by human behavior. Then I got my degree in psychology because I'm fascinated by human behavior. They're very, very similar in a way. And, you know, my job was to create stories. It was to work with writers and directors. And they created stories and made movies. I was a film executive and then a producer. And when I became a mom, I had the luxury of stepping off of that career path. It was a hard one to sustain as a mother. And I spent 5-6 years just being with my children. Didn't really have a phone to stare that much at the park. And then I went back to school and got this degree in child psychology at UCLA. And the media background informed what I studied. I did research studying media effects on children. So all of my studies, and in fact, my own children informed my choice of what to study. I did a study on the values in television because I was noticing what my child was watching. I talk about that in the book. And then I also did a study where I looked at what happened when kids spent 5 days without screens. Did their social and emotional understanding improve?
Wow. All right. Lots to dig into as we continue our conversation with Yelda Uhls. But Yelda, let's go to our listeners. And again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And first from Manchester, Ricky's on the air. Hi, Ricky. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi, giant fan. I love you guys.
Great.
So I am a instructor at a residential intensive therapeutic facility for behavioral and developmentally challenged youth. And, you know, devices are constantly being used in their therapy. So a lot of these kids are walking around with their own personal devices that they're incessantly engaged with. And I found that rather than curbing them away from that technology, if I incorporate material that I think they should be exposed to into the item that they're using, they take to it like fish to water. So instead of me handing them a copy of a paper copy of Tolkien, if I put an ebook on their reader, they already have this ingrained investment in using this device because it is part of their treatment plan. But then they have that connection to the book as well. This is my book. This is in my hands. I can read it at my pace in the way that I want. I can adjust the font, customize it, and they they become more invested in the material that I give them than if I were to just throw paper books at them.
So, Ricky, let me ask you a question. I'm so glad you called. It's really interesting. So tell us a little bit about your evolution on this, for example. Like, did you approach this job thinking I'm going to do it sort of the old-fashioned way, and then you came to realize that if you use these devices, you'd have more success? Or did you start this thinking, you know, this is where they're at, so this is where I'm going to be at?
I am a miserably hopeless nerd. There's nothing I can do about that. And I love geeky things. I love Star Trek. I love reading. I'm a geek, and I try to present what influenced me as a kid to these youth. And you hand them a book, and they look at you like you're from Mars. But if I can present it to them in a way that they digest it easier, it's incredible the differences that I get. From, well, I don't want to read this. This is a book. It's boring. Whereas, hey, just, you know, click this button, open up here. Let me show you how to download and open a movie file. And then they become invested in that process. And they need to put their fingerprints on things that I find. They need to feel that a book isn't just a journey. It's their journey that they're taking.
Well, Ricky, so interesting to hear from you. Thank you very much. What do you think, Yelda?
I think that's amazing, and I think that that is exactly the kind of thinking that we have to think about. I mean, we demonize some parents or some people, some adults demonize these screens, yet they're helping so many people. I mean, I like to say, and I don't think there's scientific evidence for this, but I like to say that screens were invented by introverts, you know, people that perhaps, you know, felt more comfortable communicating through screens. And sometimes screens help the person that doesn't want to stare at someone, you know, needs a little extra time. Needs that, you know, there are studies, and I think I put this in the book too, about Twitter being used in the classroom, in university classrooms, so that a shy person can participate because they're never going to raise their hand. I teach at college classes. I'm always trying to bring out the shy person, but it doesn't happen. And these kinds of devices help these people that may not feel normal, you know, maybe not normal, but may not feel comfortable communicating in the way that many other people communicate. Screens help them communicate.
Let's go to another call. And Ricky, again, thank you very much. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477 to Nottingham. Steve's on the air. Welcome, Steve. You're on the exchange.
Good morning. I like some of those innovative. I'm a college professor, and I'm going to take the opposite approach. First thing I do when I have a classroom is I wreck the room and I put the chairs in a U or circle so there's a discussion rather than a lecture. However, what I find is a great impediment is the students, I just have to, they cannot live for more than a few minutes without checking their cell phone. That disrupts the classroom. You can't have a conversation. And one teacher, amazingly, actually asked, collects the cell phones before class so they can't use them. But I have students that actually get incredibly anxious if they have a few minutes that they can't check Facebook.
And that takes away from what you're trying to do, Steve, as a professor. Let's engage in some in-depth material here.
In the classroom, in the old-fashioned way, and with discussion and dialogue. Yes. Yippee.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for calling in. And this is another good point, Yelda. You know, you do hear teachers, and I talk to my kids' teachers, you know, students seem just perpetually itchy, and they can't focus for more than, you know, 5 minutes. What do you think? Thank you, Steve, for calling in.
Well, I do agree, and in fact, I quote in the book Craig Shirky, who used to let laptops in the classroom, and now he's banned them because he feels that they are distracting. And people, I mean, when someone has something that can distract them, when there are moments that they are not feeling engaged, they will, you know, look at if the phone is there, if there's a device around them, they'll look at those devices. So in the classroom, you have to make that choice. And I think that choice should be left to individual teachers. And they should feel perfectly fine taking back the classroom and banning devices and letting children live through anxiety. There was actually a study a few years ago that said college students would rather have electric shocks than be bored. for a few minutes.
Wow.
And that is actually part of human behavior. Like, we need stimulation. I mean, that's how psychologists test babies. Babies are looking straight ahead. If they look away, they look away when they're bored. We get bored. We need distraction.
All right, Steve, thank you for the call. And we will pick up on babies and tech, by the way, Yelda, in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, author Yelda Uhls with her new book, Media Moms and Digital Dads. We want you to call in 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. How much tech do you think is too much tech? Where do you draw the lines with your own kids or in your own life? What are your concerns around ever-present digital media for our children, for adults, for our society? Again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. You know, Yelda, at the beginning of the show, you talked about some of the key worries that you hear from people all the time. One of the ones you mentioned was kids, young people are addicted/obsessed with this. And we just heard from Stephen Nottingham, a college professor who really seems to feel that way. I'd love some more thoughts from you on that, as to whether that's true. Can college students or high school students sit in a circle like Steve describes and really focus on what the professor is saying without itching for their phones and their Instagram?
Well, I would probably say anecdotally, no. I'm not sure there's evidence on it. But the question for me would be, could they have done that 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago when there wasn't phones? When I was in college, I probably spaced out. I would write. I would doodle. There were other things that I would do to distract me because we only really, you know, focusing is challenging, and focusing for long periods of time is challenging. These devices certainly are very alluring. They, you know, I find myself wanting to check my email all of the time. I mean, there's definitely the reward pathway definitely gets lights up when we use these things. So there is something to the fact that these devices are so easy to fill our time with. But have we fundamentally changed? Is that something new? I'm not totally sure about that.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, because that was another one of the big concerns that you hear. You know, has the ubiquity of these devices, not just for kids, for everybody, changed the brain? You often hear people say that, you know, digital natives, their brains are wired differently, et cetera, or that these devices are making everybody more distracted, changing our brains. But you did the research. What'd you find, Yelda?
Well, I mean, there's really very little evidence that the brain has changed. Beyond the fact that the brain changes every day, all of the time, you know, our brains are changing. Plasticity means that the environment influences our brain activity depending on what's in our environment. So it is changing, but there's very little evidence that it's changing in fundamental ways, that the structure's changing. There also hasn't been that much study yet. I mean, there isn't enough funding to study the brain, especially with developing brains when kids are younger. These studies are enormously costly. But the reality is we are, you know, responding to our environment. And that's why one of the things that I also say in the book is it's very important for each of us to build some time in our day where we put the devices down, and for families to build that time together. So everybody puts the device down. Device-free dinner could be something that they do. Device-free dinner could be your baseline. You could do more than that, you know, conversation, game time. Anything where mom, dad, grandparents, you know, anybody in the family, any caregiver puts the phones down and tell the kids to put devices down too. And we're just going to have some time with no media.
Well, one of the fears that you talk about too in the book, and this is a headline from 2013, Google makes you stupid. So again, on this idea of, you know, whether this is changing our brains or not, what about that? Does Google make you stupid?
Well, if you were my son, he argues that Google makes you very, very smart. And, you know, there was an article in Science where they talked about Google outsourcing your brain to Google. You remember more. You can't remember what's on your computer, but you can remember where the file is on your computer to find the thing that you're looking for. So maybe we're just becoming more efficient in finding information. I mean, it does. The written word, that's what Plato said. You know, the written word makes you stupid. Would we make that argument today? I mean, maybe Google is the new written word. I'm just throwing it out there.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Yelda, here's a question we asked on Facebook. Do you try to limit screen time for your kids? What do you think of the risks? Alyssa says, yes, I think the risks are creating a sedentary lifestyle and the loss of interaction with real life. She says, as my kids are older now, I worry about video games. I grew up in the 70s and 80s and love video games, but a lot of the ones they want contain violence of some sort. I find myself compromising more than I thought I would. A couple points, actually, from this Facebook comment, and thank you, Alyssa. First of all, her first point, sedentary lifestyle and the loss of interaction with real life. What do you think about that, Yelda?
I think those are definitely risks. I mean, sedentary lifestyle, most of this stuff requires sitting, unless it's an interactive video game. They've tried to, you know, engage children in that, but they're not, you know, it's not like everybody sits in front of a video game and jumps around. Not everyone's doing Wii Fit. However, you know, I don't know if their kids playing more sports than ever before. So children, there was a study that came out recently that said, kids are only getting physical activity about an hour a day. To me, that seems like a fairly large amount of activity, physical activity. Maybe it's a lot less than when we were growing up, but, they're still getting a lot of activity in school and in after-school sports. However, you know, balance is key. And if they're sitting in front of a screen all of the time, you need to get them to do other things, physical activity as well. And the social thing, that goes back to the device-free dinner. That goes back to sitting down, staring face-to-face, you know, giving your child, teaching them that they put the phone down when someone asks them a question and they look the person in the face. This is basic behavior that you would have taught your child anyway when children would look down and not want to talk to the grown-up. You try to teach them that anyway. It becomes even more significant today.
I heard about a trend in Silicon Valley where sort of young tech professionals, if they go out to dinner together, some of them are putting their phones in the middle of the table, and the first one to grab their phone, in other words, not pay attention to their friends and colleagues, has to pick up dinner. So strong incentive, strong incentive to engage with them face to face. Well, the second part of Alyssa's Facebook comment is so important and kind of an eye opener for me, too, Yelda, from your book. She's worried about the violence in video games. OK, and this, you know, this is a big concern among people, especially in an era of mass shootings. People say that, you know, young people, especially young men, consume violent media and then they go out and act violently. You conclude, quoting here, violent action games do not appear to cause deviant behavior. Wow.
Yes. So, and I've gotten a little pushback.
I bet you have.
On that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially people that have studied that. So, you know, what I looked at was the various people that study violent behavior and video games. And what I believe is that violent video games, there is a relationship if you play violent video games and short-term physical aggression. But there is nothing, as far as I could see from the research that I looked at, that shows it transfers long-term. And if you look at purely correlational data, violence is down in our society, yet violent video games are being sold at a much higher level than they ever were. So if there was indeed, if violent video games were indeed changing behavior, one would expect to see a stronger correlation. But the bigger point and the more important point is that parents actually do need to spend time thinking about content. And the American Academy of Pediatrics just recently released an article about what to talk to families about media. And in this article, what they said was think about the content more than the time limit. So it's very, very important. And organizations like Common Sense Media, who I work with, have a robust rating system for you to make the choice of what is important in your family, what kind of content fits with your family values, and to help your child choose content that you feel comfortable with. So violent video games, yes, you know, I don't believe the research concludes that they cause deviant behavior in the fact that, you know, I mean, that doesn't mean to say that if there is a disturbed human being that is playing violent video games, there isn't some, you know, influence on some level. On the other hand, you aren't really sure what came first, the chicken or the egg. And one of the studies that I talk about in that book, you know, that I go into is a propensity study, which I'm not going to go into in detail, but we, you know, it was a fairly in-depth study that actually found the only, when you looked at violent video games, one of the strongest relationships that they found is that boys that played violent video games smoked less pot than boys that didn't play those games.
Could we conclude that they got their thrill from the video game and didn't need the marijuana?
Yeah, I mean, there's a Harvard psychologist that did some studies on this, and I heard her speak once, and she basically said, look, you know, these are an emotional outlet for a lot of kids. You know, they go to school, they do whatever they're going to do, and they come home, you know, and the way that I start the book is I looked at, you know, monitoring the futures statistics, and kids are doing less drugs than they used to do. They are drinking less than they used to. Their violent behavior is down. We are more tolerant as a society. There's all these indicators that our children are not, you know, turning to, horrific people. You know, our society is evolving in positive ways. So, yet at the same time, media content is we have some of the worst media content we've ever had before. You know, some of those games are horrific, and I certainly wouldn't advise them for young children.
Well, it's interesting. There's one particular game store that my boys like to go to, and I'm at the point now, Yelda, where I can't even go in there with them because I just can't stand, you know, it's just the depictions are just so horrifying, as you said. And yet, here's a quote in your book from Elizabeth Gilbert. A lot of people might recognize that name, Eat, Pray, Love. She wrote a book called In Defense of Teenagers. Sorry, it's a Facebook post. She wrote, today's American teenagers are, ready, the most sensitive, least violent, least bullying, least racist, least homophobic, most globally minded, most compassionate, most environmentally conscious, least dogmatic, and, get this, overall kindest group of young people this country has ever No. Now, is Elizabeth Gilbert going overboard there? I mean, you just see so much violence in the media they consume, especially boys.
Yeah. I mean, that's what intrigued me. I read that quote and I decided I was going to get to the bottom of it. And I was like, well, here we have more content, more access to any kind of content that we've ever had before. You put in the search engine beheadings and you get over 2 million URLs that come up. I mean, that's insane. Kids can see anything. We haven't even talked about porn, and I don't address that in my book, but there's so much that kids can see, they can play. I mean, you were talking about video games. I get horrified by the misogyny in those games, you know, and the sexist portrayals. There's so many different things that you don't really want, you want to shield your children from. Yet, so far, the indicators don't seem to indicate that our children are acting out more than they used to. I mean, at least from a correlational point of view. Correlation is not causation, but from a correlational point of view, violent behavior is going down. So if there's more access to violent content than ever before, why wouldn't violent behavior go up?
Again,
it actually causes a change in behavior.
Our guest is Yelda Uhls. She's author of Media Moms and Digital Dads, also a research scientist at UCLA, and with Common Sense Media, a nonprofit advocacy group for families. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. What are your questions, concerns, thoughts around ever-present digital media for kids and adults and society? Are we more distracted? Is Google making us stupid? What is the impact of some of the more violent media that is out there? Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. And Mary is in Madison. Hi, Mary. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for taking me. Ilda, I both of you, I just thought that a wonderful book for you to read or check out was Switch On Your Brain, The Key to Peak Happiness, Thinking, and Health. It's by Dr. Caroline Leaf. She talks about how it's not really the best for us not to think things through. And a lot of this digital media, we're going from thing to thing. We're going from one thing to another. We're not thinking things through. And our brains, we're not wired for that. About 30 years ago, I was doing, I majored in communications at UNH. And what they were doing back then, and that was 30 years ago, and they were talking about how they kept changing the commercials and how it would be quicker and quicker commercials, 15 seconds, 10 seconds, so that our attention would keep changing. And then it would change to 15 seconds and then 10 seconds.
Mary, it sounds like you are not a fan of sort of ever-present digital media, a smartphone in every pocket. You think that's making us not think through things deeply. That
right,
seems to be your point. Yeah,
I don't see. I think that they can be very useful, and I'm not taking away that they can't be useful. I think that anything can be taken to the nth degree, and I feel like, yes, it seems like many of our children and adults have to, they're almost, it's an addiction.
Okay.
An addiction. And
Mary, thank you.
It can be an addiction.
Thanks for calling in. Sorry to jump in on you there, but I did want to get to you, Yelda, because you talked about this earlier in the show. Go ahead.
Well, one thing I wanted to say, though, because she was talking about 30 years ago, they were talking about the commercials getting shortened. That sort of seems to reflect on the conversation that I was having, that we keep having these conversations over and over again. And that was, we grew up with that sort of fear. My parents only let me watch 1 hour of television a week. You know, they were very worried about TV. So each generation worries about a media, yet I hope many of us turned out fine. So while it's normal to worry, and I totally understand having children that love this stuff, I think it's really important to educate yourself and think about what is actually true. What is the research? What is the facts bear out? And that's why I decided to write this book, is because I felt like the conversation was around typical fears of adults being worried about kids' adoption of this stuff. But as the social science has come out, and for those of us that look at the entire population, not just a small sample of the population, a clinical population, we've seen that, you know, kids are doing this stuff to do what they've always done, which is make friends, to develop their identities. And now, yes, we're getting more information. We're, you know, and there's a lot of pluses to it as well.
That's the thing that's interesting about the book, is you definitely deal with the fear, Yelda, but you also do provide some of the research that's out there. And sometimes the concern that people have is, in fact, borne out by the research, but sometimes it isn't.
Yeah. And sometimes it is. Look, I mean, it hasn't been accepted yet to the DSM-5 or you know, but there is evidence that there's internet gaming disorder. There is evidence that, you know, that perhaps in some cases, you know, there are kids that are using this stuff too much. One of the first things you should look at, though, is, you know, is there addiction in your family? Are the behaviors different than traditional addiction? Is it is the screen sucking them in or not? And, you know, the study that I did a study where we looked at kids who spent 5 days without any media whatsoever. They went to an outdoor education camp, and we compared them to kids who spent 5 days using their media as usual. So in the school, they were using media, and outside of school, they were spending 4.5 days looking at screens.
And Yelda, hang on one sec. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll talk about them when we come back. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, author Yelda Uhls on tech-savvy kids, worried parents, and how mobile digital technology that's available everywhere at all times might be affecting our brains, our society, our social interactions. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Yelda's book is Media Moms and Digital Dads. She's a research scientist at UCLA, also working with Common Sense Media. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Yelda, we've talked a lot about sort of media's impact on learning and intellectual development, the impact or lack thereof of violent media. Let's get into what you started to get into just before the break, social interactions. You were starting to tell us about an experiment that you did with one group of kids who stayed on their devices, you know, all the time or a lot of the time, like normal. Another group of kids who unplugged for 5 days. Go ahead.
Yes. So the kids that unplugged for 5 days were at an outdoor education camp, and the kids that used their devices as normal were in school, and they, you know, had their media just like they always do. And so we looked at their ability to understand nonverbal emotional cues. So those are things like tone of voice, facial expression, the way you move your hands, body posture, context. And we tested them before on the Monday of school, first day of school, and the Monday, first day of camp, and after Friday, the end of the camp, and Friday, last day of school, to see if there was any change in their ability to understand these cues. And the kids that went to the camp within 5 days, they got better at understanding these nonverbal emotional cues.
So their emotional intelligence, that's what they
exactly.
call it, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, emotional understanding got better. They were able to, you know, and our takeaway was, one, that it took only 5 days for them to get better. So the screens weren't sucking it away. You know, that's why I, you know, advocate fairly strongly for building time into your day with no devices whatsoever. And then two, that, that the camp itself, the group interaction, the face-to-face interaction was probably a significant reason why they were able to start to learn how to understand this, which is why we need to spend time, like that professor said, you know, putting the devices down and sitting in the classroom or in the around the family dinner or around the coffee table having conversation.
So in a way, the good news is it didn't take long for their emotional intelligence to, you know, show itself fully. The downside to me listening to you, Yelda, is that it seems like you're saying their emotional intelligence, that basic ability to read, you know, tone of voice, facial cues and so forth, had been diminished.
Well, they got better in the short term. So diminished is a strong word.
Yeah.
I don't want to go there. But I mean, the thing is, if they're looking at screens, if someone is only looking at screens and they're not looking at faces or their environment, you know, they're not going to learn the same things. I mean, video, it does not teach the same thing as a face or as a landscape. You know, it's an impoverished version of the real world. So it is really important to have, you know, especially when children are very young, to allow them to experience the world as it really is versus through a screen.
Yeah, you say, especially for the youngest kids, the real world is always better. Always.
Yeah, and I always think about WALL-E, that movie, the Pixar movie where, you know, the grown-ups had gotten quite sedentary and obese and were staring at screens and not talking to each other. It's like, we don't want to go there. Let's make sure that we build face-to-face time and conversation into every day.
So if emotional intelligence can be boosted by 5 days unplugged, how do you build that? I mean, there's no app for that, it sounds like you're saying, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually one of the reasons we were so happy to do it at this camp, was because it's very hard to find kids who will spend that much time without screens. I mean, it really starts with the adult in the home. You have to do it yourself. You have to take the time away from the device. You have to model the behavior. And then, you know, take longer breaks. You don't need 5 days. You know, it's just really about giving, and we, you know, the thing about that experiment is it wasn't a perfect experiment. They were out in nature. They were in a camp environment where they had lots of group interaction. We're not sure if it was the screens. We're not sure if it was the fact that they were spending a lot of time looking at each other's faces and having these group activities. We feel it's actually the likelihood is the group activities. So you know, give your child and your family lots of time to learn socialization in the traditional way, face-to-face.
Let's take another call. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's go to Heather in Amherst. Hi, Heather. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much. I'd like to share a little bit of a different experience that my family had playing the game called Minecraft. I have a son who, at the age of 9, was diagnosed with what it was used to be called Asperger syndrome. I don't believe they're calling it that anymore, but he had he had some pretty profound difficulties communicating both with his peers and also with me and his family. And he started playing this game, which for people that don't know about it, is just a there's not really any violence in it. It's all about creativity and building and strategy and survival. And it's a really, really great game. And I saw him start to become kind of, you know, as you would say, obsessed with this game. And rather than getting on his case about it, I actually learned how to play the game myself. And the two of us started playing together. And we ultimately found a family-friendly server called Intercrafton, where we could play together, and we could play actually with other kids that faced some similar challenges socially and verbally, you know, communication-wise. And we were able to develop this new way of communicating with each other. And so for us, the media and these video games turned out to be something very positive. And he's now 14, and this is his first year of high school. And he has made such unbelievable strides socially and intellectually, and I have to say that so much of that came from being a part of this game and playing this game and being part of a community where we all played together and we all played cooperatively.
Well, and that's so interesting, yeah, Heather, that you raised that point, because one of the things that I have seen change in terms of video games, Yelda, is, you know, going from sort of, you plug it in and you play it. Now there's a whole community of people that you are connecting with. And so it's kind of, you're not just sort of holed up all by yourself when you're playing these games.
Exactly. And Heather, I love that story. And I think that is, it's been a real source of comfort. And, you know, there are apps for kids that are autistic or have trouble learning, that have different learning difficulties. You know, a lot of these screens actually help kids like that learn how to communicate, learn how to understand facial expressions, learn the ways to socialize themselves. And those kinds of experiences are amazing. So I think that, and Minecraft is a fantastic game.
Thank you, Heather, for the call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And, you know, Yelda, again, getting away from just kids, because this is, you know, almost everybody is finding their lives changed by the use of devices everywhere. You've got a funny bit in your book about multitasking, and boy, we could do a whole hour on this. I'm going to read from the book, okay? This is concerning you. It was my daughter's 15th birthday, and I attempted 5 different conversations at once. How is this even humanly possible? Let me explain. Here is a list of each exchange. 1, live chatting with the Comcast agent. 2, texting my daughter's friend who was planning a birthday event. 3, texting with my mother, who wrote to tell me she loved the birthday photo I sent. 4, holding on the phone to schedule a doctor's appointment. And 5, yelling back and forth with my husband, who was in another room. To top it all off, I was baking a cake.
Can you relate?
I can, especially waiting online for the doctor, because you wait forever. So why sit there? But what about this idea of, you know, devices help us multitask, but how much multitasking can we really, honest to goodness, do?
Well, Well, you know, I mean, there has been a lot of research on this, and multitasking is basically impossible to do two activities at the same level of excellence at the same time. We do rapid device switching, rapid task switching, which a lot of people talk about. However, that doesn't mean that, you know, sitting on the phone waiting for a doctor, I'm sitting there wasting time. That doesn't mean I can't effectively do something that, like that, which doesn't require a lot of cognitive resources, and also do another task and another task. It, I may fail or I may not be quite as successful in one of the tasks, but not every single task needs to be done perfectly. So it's really a matter of figuring out what you're doing. And I look at a lot of the multitasking research. And in fact, we did some at the Children's Digital Media Center at UCLA, where I do the research. And we found that reading from papers, reading from screens, in terms of memory and comprehension, one of the only things that made a difference in the multitasking condition when kids were multitasking was that it took longer to read. But at the same time, they did not perform worse on tasks of memory. Even when they had the internet and they were multitasking, they still could remember, and their comprehension was the same. So, but however, when they were multitasking and writing a paper, their grades got worse. So when you have to really focus, you can't do multitasking.
Well,
it should be obvious, though, right?
Yeah, well, except, right, that example I just read. I love that you were baking a cake at the same time. I'm wondering.
Yeah, the cake turned out.
Well, that's impressive, because whenever I try to massively multitask like that, I burn the toast. You know, since you talked about reading and writing, I thought it was really interesting. You said, and you just mentioned there, people debate whether reading on screen or from paper is better in terms of retaining information. You said it doesn't matter. But then you found that writing, note-taking, is better with a pen and paper. How come?
Well, what was so interesting about that was a great study. That was, and the theory that the scientist offered was that it's because you have to encode when you're writing. So when they had kids type the notes while watching, they watched a TED talk, and then they would type the notes. And their thinking was, when they were typing the notes, they were doing it verbatim. While when you have to write by hand, you have to encode it, you have to process it, you're paraphrasing. So possibly, if someone could actually take notes and do that same kind of process while typing, they might be able to memorize information in the same way. But writing is a process that, you know, you really have to use your brain a little bit more to remember everything and to think it through. So handwriting still is not dead. There is still use for it.
Well, here's a Facebook comment from Liz, who says, I worry about device-centered students not having the experiences of sustained focus contemplation. Liz says, student, quote, boredom seems to me often an inability to concentrate or contemplate or be silent, still in a way that can invite listening, insight, understanding, learning, etc. Liz, thank you for the comment. And here's another one from Alan. Here's an email. He says, why would any kids struggle or work hard to learn a skill, play an instrument, learn a language, or stay with anything long enough to grow if they can just turn on a device and have instant success? Alan, thank you for the email. Now, what do you think about this, Yelda, the idea that, you know, online you can get it, quickly, mm-hmm. and ta-da, you can pull enough coins down from the game or get lots of likes for your photo or whatever, and that stuff in real life is sometimes harder and grittier. What do you think about Alan's comment?
I think for the kid that is that instant gratification kid and the kid that might have trouble with impulse control, I mean, those kids have always been around. It's not a change in human behavior. For that child, probably, you know, it is a concern. In that child, you may want to give them time where they're just bored or make them, you know, help them focus on a task. Those are skills they're going to have to learn. And, you know, the internet does give you instant gratification. I get worried about my own sort of ability to look at something up and Google something immediately and not do the extra work. But for a lot of us, you know, there's people still focusing and solving problems. There are kids doing it. You know, if there's one of the things I say, if there's nobody inside your child's world that is saying that sits outside of your family home, if there's a teacher, if there are no teachers or counselors or any other adults in their lives saying there's an issue, there's probably not an issue. If they're doing well in school, then maybe you don't need to worry about it. But for some kids, you do.
You know, Yelda, we haven't even talked about this, and I do want to raise it, even though we're nearing the end of the hour. We've talked so much about the devices themselves and the distraction and the constant flow of information. You write a lot in this book, too, though, about just the content of social media, especially for tweens and teens, at a time when kids' whole identities are really developing. You know, here's who I am, here's who I am not. And then you see pictures on Instagram and Facebook and so forth. I would love just your thoughts about the need to walk carefully through, especially a younger teen, having a social media account.
Yeah. I mean, I really advocate strongly that when your child, when you decide that your child is going to have a phone, go on social media, have this complete access to this new sort of environment where they can communicate with their friends anytime, anywhere with the press of a button, that you are there with them, that you join their social media, that you make some kind of device contract or family media agreement, that you talk to them about it, and that you help them sort of process it and think about it. That doesn't mean comment on anything that they do, but if you see something inappropriate or if you see something great, talk to them about it offline, help them understand, because they're still learning. They're still learning how to communicate. And you online, they're living through two adolescents. They're living through one online and they're living through one offline. It was bad enough for me offline learning how to react, right? So online, they've got to learn this stuff too. And it's important for you to be there.
Well, and there is, you know, even though Instagram, I guess, especially for the younger kids, it's like, look at this picture of my cat, look at this picture of my dog. I found out about the Paris terrorist attacks through my younger son. He was looking at Instagram,
wow.
And he said, Mom, what happened in Paris? And I hadn't heard. And so that was, you know, a moment for me where I thought, okay, I guess I really need to tap into this a little bit more. So,
right,
anyway.
Because then you've got to help him process
right,
it, right?
Right,
exactly.
And I was shocked. I said, wow, what happened? So, anyway.
Right.
Yelda, this has been great. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. We really appreciate it.
Laura, it's been a joy. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Yelda Uhls, author of Media Moms and Digital Dads. Again, Yelda is a research scientist at UCLA. She works with Common Sense Media, a nonprofit advocacy group for families. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larson. Today in The Exchange, we say goodbye, good luck, and thank you for all your hard work to our wonderful intern, Hallie Loft. Thank you, Hallie. We'll miss you. This is NHPR.